Hello, and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. My name's John Connolly, and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Last week, Nigel Farage revealed that he'd placed a £1,000 bet on his new Brexit party coming top in EU elections. Today, new polling by YouGov revealed that his money might have been a good bet, with the Brexit party coming top on 27%. James, is this surprising for a new party?
Look, it's obviously very impressive to go from being founded to 27% in a matter of weeks. I think what is interesting is, in the lead-up to this European elections, there was a view that the second referendum parties and the Brexit party would do very well. At the moment, it is just the Brexit party that is getting these big numbers. Labour's strategic ambiguity on whether it supports or second referendum or not seems to be working for it, in that it hasn't seen its vote share fall by as much as the Conservatives have. I do, though, think that if the Brexit party do win these European elections, it's going to affect the Brexit debate. Because on the one hand, it is going to make Tory MPs who want no deal more convinced that that is the electoral route the party should take. And on the other hand, I think it will make some people on the kind of Remain side of the argument more wary of the idea of a second referendum. In very crude terms, if you add up the Brexit Party, Tory and UKIP score in this poll, you get to 49% of the vote. That would seem to me to indicate that you couldn't think that a second referendum is going to be a slam dunk for Remain. Mm.
And we've heard a lot of talk already about sort of saying the Remain side is very split between lots of different parties. Do you think that's the case, or do you think it's more that they're losing the argument?
I think if you look at the numbers, I mean, UKIP does fairly well in this poll if you think about where UKIP was. I mean, it's only 7%. The Tories are technically a pro-Brexit party, and they are on 15%. The Brexit party is on 27%. It doesn't seem that parties are being punished for having lots of different pro-Brexit policies. So I don't think it is particularly that there isn't a clear message. You have Chuck. I don't know how we say it these days since it moved from Tig. But, you know, that is a mere 6%. And I would say perhaps that is partly down to some strategic decisions which the Brexit party has made, which the independent group has not. So we have recess week. Now, the independent group launched in a recess week and got a lot of media attention. It's a smart thing to do because there's less going on in Parliament, minus the constant leadership parade. But this week, the Brexit party have been doing lots of things. They had their launch on Friday. And you do get the sense that the independent group, or now Change, could be using this time, since they have made that decision to field candidates in the EU elections, to drum up some more support, make some more announcements. I think that that is probably an element here. But when you look at the results, I mean, I think Tories being on 15%, everyone does expect this to be an absolute horror show for the Conservative Party. I think that when it comes to the view of the Conservative Party, I think, given that most Tory voters don't think these elections should be happening, it's hard to see how they could do okay. I think that when you combine it, however, with local elections, that will have a big impact on the mood of the party. I think if local elections are also horrific for the Tory party, that is a point when I think some Conservative MPs who aren't as, you know, the Marc Francois of this world might start to take different views on perhaps the current leadership, but also who should perhaps replace Theresa May, as James touches on in his column.
Which brings us on nicely to James's column this week. In there you say that it's definitely the Tories' failure to sort of reach a Brexit negotiation is definitely going to hit them in the next elections, but there's sort of a debate going on about which strategy or direction the party should take afterwards.
So essentially there are two schools of thought about this. One says, double down on Leave voters. You know, that you've got to get these Leave voters back. The only way the Tories get to 40% in the polls is they can basically pull back together that Leave coalition that they've had in the past. And if they're going to get a majority, the easiest route to do that lies through gaining Labour Leave seats such as Bishop Auckland. And that, if you're going to do that, that requires a Brexiteer as leader. And that almost certainly probably requires Boris Johnson as the lever with the biggest electoral appeal and draw. The other argument goes, we've seen this movie before. You know, in 2015, UKIP got 13% of the vote. The Tory party still won a majority because it went back to its traditional electoral coalition. And the mistake in 2017 was to alienate that coalition through, not necessarily through Brexit, but through rhetoric, you know, citizens of nowhere, through policy on social care, and through a sense that you could have weren't interested in the views of people who have backed the Tory party in 2015 from the more liberal end of the spectrum. And I think what we're going to see is the Tory leadership contest is going to turn into a debate about which of these two strategies is more likely to yield electoral success. You know, is it going to be doubling down on Brexit, or is it going to be saying, look, we've got to get a Brexit deal through, but what we've also got to concentrate on is going back to that classic Cameroon coalition.
And you say a lot of this depends on Labour's sort of policy. How so?
Because I think if Labour were to back a second referendum, the case for Boris Johnson has either become stronger, because Labour at that point are a kind of Brexit-blocking party, or can easily be portrayed as that. However, if you end up getting a Brexit deal through with Labour's help, then I don't think the Tories are really going to be able to attack Labour on Brexit. So you are looking at a very different kind of coalition to win electorally.
And will this change a lot if Theresa May's deal is passed sort of before October?
I think a lot would change if Theresa May's deal was passed. I think the challenge now is, how do you pass it at this point in the process? I mean, that is very hard. I think the DUP are properly off the train. And I think if you look at those Tory Brexiteers who voted against the deal at the first time of asking, your Steve Bakers and your Marc Francois, they haven't responded with kind of agonised regret over whether they maybe did the wrong thing. But instead, you know, their trench might have been 6 feet deep before the third time this thing came back to the Commons. It's now kind of 20 feet deep. They are going further and further now. I don't see any sign of them being prepared to come round and back a deal.
Yeah, I think if you speak to figures within government who are very keen to somehow pass this deal before the EU elections, try and avoid that grisly fare for the Tories, they do accept that things are not moving in their favour. If anything, they're moving backwards. There's no momentum towards getting the deal closer. You did see the numbers each time the withdrawal agreement was voted on go down in terms of the size of the defeat. And I think there was a sense that it would just get to the point of, we've got so close now, one last heave. That has not happened. I think Brexiteers, as James says, are moving against. I think the fact that Theresa May has entered talks with Labour has pushed a lot of Brexiteers away, because they think she is willing to risk Brexit, which they are offended by. And then there's the matter that even if she does somehow find something to agree with Labour, there's a lot of unease about whether Jeremy Corbyn would actually go through with it, or would he just push the Tory party to the point of breaking and then walk away and say, actually, we're not going to help anymore. And also, if they did somehow agree on something like a permanent customs union, which is no given, because there are people like Emily Thornberry and Keir Starmer in Labour who want a second referendum, would that have a majority in the Commons? There are plenty of Conservative MPs who don't think it necessarily would, because you would lose so many votes, not just figures like Boris Johnson, probably fairly moderate, light Eurosceptics who think a customs union just doesn't make sense.
And continuing on the theme of Tory woes, you write today, Katie, about the fact that the government is debating whether or not to put forward a Queen's speech. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, so the Queen's speech should be due around June. We have had a 2-year parliamentary session, and that should in theory come to a close by the end of May. Now, Cabinet ministers have already been told that the government has nearly completed its legislative agenda. All the domestic policies have been done. But when you look at that legislation, there is one part that Theresa May hasn't quite managed to edge over. And that, of course, relates to Brexit, because she doesn't have the numbers. So you have a situation where there is currently a debate going on, in the sense there are various different views on what the government should do about this. Should the government sit on their hands and hope for a Brexit breakthrough, and at that point try and get the deal through? Should they try and force another vote, perhaps when they think they are closer to having the numbers? Now, because John Bercow has said that you cannot have the same vote twice on the same piece of legislation, the same bill, each time the government have wanted to bring the meaningful vote back, they've had to think of a different way to do it. And one way to do it would be to take the remaining piece of the Queen's speech, which relates to Brexit, and involve the withdrawal agreement in a second reading. Now, the problem is, if you do this and then MPs then reject it, you are at the end of your legislation for the whole session. So you would have to, in theory, prorogue Parliament, and bear with us on the technical terms, you would have to basically end Parliament and provide a Queen's speech. Now, a Queen's speech is something which is very difficult for a government that doesn't have a majority, because it is a confidence matter. If you put forward a Queen's speech, which is your legislative agenda, and you don't manage to pass it, the government falls. You don't have a second go at it. I mean, you try, but it means that the government has fallen. There's also the complication that the government's DUP agreement, the confidence and supply agreement, only lasts for the most recent session. If they enter a new parliamentary session, so present a Queen's speech, they have to agree this all over again with the DUP. Now, anyone who's been listening to this podcast knows that relations between the Conservatives and the DUP are not at an all-time high. They are potentially at an all-time low. And the third problem for them, if they have to present a Queen's speech, is what do you put in it? Now, the last one was pretty threadbare. It didn't have much in the way of domestic policy agenda. And that was in large because if you looked at the context or the backdrop, they had just lost the Conservative majority, and everything that was in the Tory manifesto for the snap election no longer really had the backing. So it was very thin other than on Brexit. So what could Theresa May put in that speech that she could A, expect to pass Parliament in length, and also would attract votes? And I think those are the big challenges. So you have some MPs who do think that the government should just avoid one at all costs, see what happens till November. I was speaking to someone yesterday who calmly made the point that there's nothing actually to say a government has to do a Queen's speech anytime. They can just watch the clock tick. I think this would be perhaps an approach if you look at certain countries which didn't really have an operating government. But I think we'd be testing the limits. But I think that's the safest thing to do, because how do you avoid the government being voted down?
One of the things I think about that is complicated for the government about the Queen's speech is this. The Queen's speech would have to say something about Brexit. And that's when it's in danger of being voted down. So let's imagine that the withdrawal agreement bill hasn't passed. Let's imagine they try and bring that forward in the Queen's speech. You could see a kind of alliance between ERG, Tories and Labour to say, no, don't bring that thing back. Bring something else back. At which point the Queen's speech loses and Theresa May is in a world of trouble. I think this is where things get so complicated. I think also, you know, it is quite hard to see what the motherhood and apple pie measures you would put in a Queen's speech to guarantee that it would pass would be. There isn't actually that much consensus in British politics at the moment on a whole bunch of topics, which I think does complicate things. I think Katie is undoubtedly right that the question for this government is, do they have anything left to do or not? And if Theresa May admits that there isn't anything left in the domestic locker, let alone the Brexit locker, then I think kind of holding on to her position becomes more difficult.
And I think if you look at what people are thinking about putting in this Queen's speech, so various government departments have been asked if there is anything they would like to try and do. I mean, one thing being talked about is the environment. Most people can agree something should be done on the environment. And I mean, one minister suggested to me that Theresa May could actually try and play the whole thing to her advantage. She could use a Queen's speech to try and pick a few legacy topics. Given that she has accepted she's on the way out, she doesn't want to be remembered for either only delivering Brexit or not delivering Brexit. So at that point, she could try and pick things such as her previous modern slavery agenda. But it's very hard to see what topics she could really give a lasting impression on, given they would have to be so unoffensive to any particular party.
I think it was on Nikki DaCosta's point, I mean, this is that all of these bills could be ambushed. Let's say you came forward with a kind of let's not drop plastic in the oceans bill anymore, right? You think everyone could vote for that. How would the government then respond if Caroline Lucas, leader of the Green Party, for example, said, well, the way we're going to respect the environment is by pledging dynamic alignment with EU environmental standards and trying to put that into the bill? I mean, that one of the things that is so difficult is because you can't quite know what the Speaker is going to rule to be in scope as an amendment. The government could think it was piloting a very uncontroversial piece of legislation through the House of Commons, only to get mugged halfway through the process and find it suddenly becomes very controversial.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. Thank you for listening. We also have an offer running at the moment for The Spectator, where you can get 12 issues for £12 plus a £20 John Lewis voucher. To access the offer, simply go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.